Hello, I'm David O'Keefe. This is number 0587, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0587. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet veteran actor Hank Garrett, who has written his memoir called From Harlem Hoodlum to Hollywood Heavy. He went from being a cop in real life to acting as a not-so-bright cop on the classic sitcom Car 54, Where Are You?
A friend of mine whose wife was working for Max Hyken, who created Car 54, was working on the show at the time, and he got me an audition. I went down. Matt Hyken looked at me and just said, "You're Ed Nicholson." I said, "Oh, no, I'm Hank Garrett." And he said, "Just the kind of dummy I'm looking for. Ed Nicholson is the character you're going to play on this show." And I went, "Oh."
Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com is back with a November story of a clown who actually ran for president of the United States.
There was one case where an actual clown did run for president. His name was Dan Rice, and he was a candidate for the presidency in 1868. And Dan Rice is a name that probably most people don't know, but at the time, he was one of the most famous people in America as a clown. Of course, he was even more than a clown. He was a true entertainer and a showman.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0587, was historian David O'Keefe, who is the author of several great wartime histories, including One Day in August, his book about Canada's efforts during the Dieppe raids of the Second World War. The book has been out for a while in Canada, but it just got released this week in the United States. And by the way, David and I spent a lot of our time in our youth playing Strat-O-Matic baseball. A lot of time. So I thank you for that as well. And by the way, no, I'm still not trading you Roger Clemens for Burt Blyleven. It ain't happening, Dave. But again, thank you for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. People like Gary Whitgriff, who you heard on the show just a couple of weeks ago, the author of Destination North Pole, about his 5,000-kilometer bike ride from South Dakota to North Pole, Alaska. He has become a patron of the show via Patreon.com. So I thank you very, very much for that, Gary. And to all people out there, join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 47-year-old Kimberly Ragsdale apparently had a plan to get free food at a Chick-fil-A restaurant in Rockmart, Georgia, and it ended up in her arrest on charges of impersonating a public officer on November the 5th. According to the police, Ragsdale of Dallas had repeatedly visited the restaurant telling workers that she was an FBI agent and threatened to arrest them if they didn't serve her a complimentary meal. Ragsdale continued her charade, telling arresting officers her credentials were electronic and talking into her shirt like she was talking into a radio. Rockmart Police Chief Randy Turner said in a statement to news outlets, "You will not hear a real officer demand a meal anywhere. Hey, you in the kitchen, you have the right to feed me. Anything you serve will not be used against you in a food court. While preparing my food, you have the right to remain silent. You may have a waiter or waitress present. If you don't have one, you can bring the food to me directly. Do you understand your rights?" Still with food, an unnamed man from Idaho Falls, Idaho, pleaded guilty in a Mammoth Hot Springs, Wyoming court on September the 10th to citations including walking in restricted thermal areas of Yellowstone National Park after park rangers found him with a cooking pot and a burlap sack containing two whole chickens near a hot spring. Witnesses tipped off rangers on August the 7th that a group of 10 people, including a child, were seen hiking toward Shoshone Geyser Basin carrying cooking pots. The man was ordered to pay fines and has been banned from Yellowstone for 2 years. Wow, 2 years! Gee, what will he eat then? Meanwhile, police in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania continue to investigate two explosive incidents in area porta-potties. No one was injured in either explosion, the first of which occurred November 5th in Lawrenceville and was strong enough to blow apart the toilet and damage a nearby home. The second came on November the 10th in East Allegheny. Pittsburgh's bomb squad and crime unit is working to determine what types of explosives were used and whether the events are related. Type of explosive? Has anybody looked into beans? Police in Fruitland Park, Florida, arrested Ronnie Lee Kimberlin of Leesburg on October 31st on charges of theft and disturbing a grave after she allegedly repeatedly removed items left at her ex-husband's grave by his fiancé. The grieving fiancé first complained to police in late September, saying items missing from the grave included a pair of $250 sunglasses, hanging LED lights, hanging planters, artificial flowers, a ring, and assorted other items, all valued at more than $400. Kimberlin denied involvement, but the arrest affidavit noted an ex-roommate came forward saying she was with Kimberlin when she stole the items, and police found some of the missing planters at Kimberlin's brother's home. Okay, as disturbing as this story is, I do have one question. Why is the fiancé leaving more than $400 worth of merch at the grave? Sunglasses and a light show? What is this, Studio 54? In China's Lishu City, Zhejiang Province, 27-year-old Liu Qingzhen has found his calling as a bad uncle for hire by parents wanting him to scare their children into obedience. He's created a short custom video using the child's name and making scary faces while threatening them to behave. "If you don't do your homework, don't eat, and don't go to sleep, I will take you away," he warns in one video. One happy customer posted, "My 3-year-old son was scared at first sight, and he was immediately obedient." Oh, let's just wait about 15 years when that combination of PTSD and repressed memories kicks in. That's when the fun begins. A couple had planned to get married in Bath, England in July, but the coronavirus got in the way of that. Now that the country is locking down again due to a resurgence of COVID-19, they quickly tied the knot at the same venue while they had the chance. Kieran White and Tilly Christmas, both 20, met in school when they were only 12 and decided to hyphenate their names to be Mr. and Mrs. White Christmas. Oh, they must be dreaming.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Exactly. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, according to parishioners and employees of St. Joseph's Church in Selma, California, Father Guadalupe Rios shouldn't be allowed to come within 100 yards of the church that still has his name on the marquee. That's according to the restraining order that the Roman Catholic Diocese of Fresno requested. Several parishioners said Rios is affiliated with a gang and has been seen on social media with an assault rifle and handgun, which were later seized from his church office. The church secretary, who allegedly had a physical and romantic relationship with Rios for 5 years, said he threatened himself and her with the guns. Said the secretary in a statement to police, "I'm afraid when he finds out about the diocese knowing the truth about him, he would come after me in retaliation." He also has a DUI conviction on his record and, according to the secretary, was often under the influence of alcohol and marijuana. A judge approved the order, and Rios isn't allowed to come close to the church, the diocese, or several of the people who contributed to the request. Wow. Guns, girls, drugs, and God. He's the total package, isn't he? Yeah. You know, you're supposed to fear God, not your priest. Whenever Father Rios gets to the pearly gates, which I like to refer to as Heaven's HR department, he really has some explaining to do. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? You might not recognize Hank Garrett by his name, but once you see him, you'll know that you recognize him from a myriad of movies and television shows. On the big screen, he's worked with the likes of Sophia Loren, Kirk Douglas, Robert Redford, and James Coburn, just to name a few. On TV, it would be easier to list the shows he hasn't worked on. Hank is someone who went from a gun-toting kid to a gun-toting cop to a gun-toting TV cop. He writes about his life in the book From Harlem Hoodlum to Hollywood Heavy. And Hank joins us on the line from California. Hi, Hank.
Hello.
Thanks for being on the program with us. It's an honor and pleasure to have a chance to talk with you. You've written this book, and it's got to be one of those situations where what do you not put in? Because you've had and continue to live such a full life.
Yes, it's been quite exciting. Didn't think so at the time. I was a street hoodlum as a kid. I lived on the street. In fact, I slept in cardboard boxes. My parents were immigrants they were from Russia. And they were so busy trying to make a living, they sold fruits and vegetables on a pushcart. And rarely did I see them. So I lived on the street, myself and a young friend of mine, George Washington Jr., who had a similar situation. His mom had passed, and his dad was so busy looking for work. So the two of us were street rats. Actually, we were called hoodlums. And we were tough kids.
You know, I would assume that so many kids of your generation in your situation went down, let's say, a more precarious route and probably didn't survive. But you, and as I mentioned, you were a gun-toting kid. So, you weren't a sweetheart, but you managed to turn your life around. What was it in life that gave you that direction that you needed?
God sent me an angel by the name of Sammy Davis Jr. Man who was my mom's customer, and my mom was crying to him. He happened to be the mayor of Harlem. He was a musician, and he took me to meet Sammy Davis Jr. And I didn't know who Sammy Davis Jr. was, but we went to the Apollo Theater. We went right to Sammy's dressing room, and Sam said to me, the mayor said, "You're a tough kid, and you're going to wind up with a lot of scars and broken bones." He said, and he also said that you're going to either go to prison and or die. I was 12 years old. And I said, "That's it." And then I realized I had a 25 caliber pistol in my pocket, 12 years old. And Sammy got me a job working with an African-American band. And I was a band boy. What I had to do was put the music out for the musicians. And after the gig, after the job, repack all the music and put them away in proper cases. And the band leader, Lucky Millinder, gave me $50 at the end of the evening. And I said, $50? He said, "Get yourself some new kicks, shoes." My shoes were torn to shreds. And I, $15, I bought a pair of Florsheim shoes. And I gave my mom $35. More money than she had seen in Lord knows when.
Wow.
And that was the start.
Now,
and I started working at the Catskill Mountains as a comic from jokes I had collected and stolen. And 20 smart years later, I was Tony Bennett's opening act at the Sands.
Wow. You know, as the last part of your book would indicate, the last part of your title, from Harlem Hoodlum to Hollywood Heavy, I've had the opportunity to talk to many a character actor who have often played villains or tough guys on the big screen. And I find that to a person, every one of them seems to be just the nicest person in the world. Nothing like the characters they played. And I sense that you are very similar in that regard as well.
Yeah, I hope so. I was very fortunate. I wound up winning the New York Film Critics Award for a movie I did with Robert Redford, a movie called 3 Days of the Condor. And not too long ago, we were taken to Vegas, and I was given a special award for best fight scene in film ever.
Wow.
So,
you know, as a teenager, I was a theater usher. I worked in a theater that played 3 Days of the Condor. And just recently, I decided to watch that fight scene again. It is a great fight scene. And not only from the point of view of the two of you guys in the fight scene, but also it's a scene that doesn't have any music background. There's no score to it. So what you hear is the fight. And did that take a long time to choreograph? Because there's a lot of moving parts in that particular fight scene in that small apartment.
The guy who did the choreography for it was a martial artist. I'm a martial artist. I'm considered a grandmaster. I'm in the Karate Hall of Fame, and I'm also in the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. I wrestled as Hank Daniels, the Minnesota farm boy, which is interesting because I'd never seen a farm, nor have I ever been to Minnesota. So, and it was, it was really, really staged beautifully. And Redford and I were he wound up saving my eyesight. Because I was supposed to get hit in the face with a pot of coffee. And it was some kind of an acid diluted with mineral oil. And Bob wasn't even involved in the shot. It was going to be a tight close-up of me getting the coffee in my face. And he came out of his dressing room and he said, "Why is this coffee still steaming?" And the special effects guy said, "Well, that's the chemicals that we use. It's not really hot at all." And he stuck his finger and said, "See, it doesn't burn." And Bob said, "Well, what happens if you get it in your eye?" And it got very quiet on the set. And he walked over to the director, Sidney Pollack, and he said, "Sid, can I throw the coffee?" And he said, "Yeah, sure." And so he said to me, "Hank, I'm going to throw the coffee, and it's going to hit you waist high. But I want you to blow your hands up as though it hit you in the face." Come to find out, had it gotten in my eyes, it would have blinded me.
Wow.
Yeah. And how do I thank Robert Redford for saving my eyesight? I break his nose in the fight scene. Oh, what gratitude.
one of your earlier television gigs, and again, if people take a look at just at your IMDb or Google you and look at a picture, they'll go, "Oh, yeah, I know that guy." And they'll all list different things. You were in Car 54, Where Are You? And
yes,
the television show. And by the way, we haven't got a lot of time. We're skipping a piece here. You, between the time you were a stand-up and you met Sammy Davis Jr. and you had a gun as a kid, you were a police officer.
Yes, for about a minute and a half. I thought if I became a cop, I could make a difference on the streets, and I found that it was futile. And fortunately, a friend of mine whose wife was working for Nat Hiken, who created Car 54, who was working on the show at the time, and he got me an audition. I went down, and then Nat Hiken looked at me and just said, "You're Ed Nicholson." I said, "Oh, no, I'm Hank Garrett." And he said, "Just the kind of dummy I'm looking for. Ed Nicholson is the character you're going to play on the show." And I went, "Oh." And the next day I was being fitted with different uniforms.
We're talking with actor Hank Garrett, author of his life story entitled From Harlem Hoodlum to Hollywood Heavy. We'll take a quick break and continue talking with Hank in just a few moments. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And this is indeed The Stuff File Program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can find buttons for Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or iHeartRadio right on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. And we are talking with Hank Garrett about his amazing life on both the big and small screen. He writes about his life in the book From Harlem Hoodlum to Hollywood Heavy. And Hank, you have played so many cops since that first role in Car 54, Where Are You? I'm just curious to know, as an actor and a former cop, what's the thing that's farthest away from what being a real police officer was like in any of the roles you played?
I became the character that the script called for. There was a tough cop in Serpico. I had to be a really tyrant. And the change of playing a not too bright person, which is more like me, on Car 54, and it fit like a glove. It really did. I didn't have to try to be mean or anything other than myself. Thanks to Nat Hiken, who directed us, and oh, God. What a time of my life. In fact, I am the only member left from that show. Everyone else is gone. Only because I started the show. When I came on the show, I was a teenager. I was 18 years old. I had lied about my age to get my wrestling license. I was wrestling pro, 16 and 17 years old. And they found out and said, "You got to get a license." I said, how old do I have to be? And they said, "At least 21. Well, they got me a license saying that I was 25 years old. And actually, 26. Yeah. I was 16. And they made my age 10 years older than I was.
With all the things that have happened to you in your early life and growing up in Harlem and doing the things you did before you met Sammy Davis Jr. and the plethora of jobs and different directions that you've gone into, when you were growing up, what did little Hank Garrett want to be?
I didn't know. I didn't know. I knew I was hanging out with a bad crew. I was one of them. In fact, I was a member of an all-black group, and we were on the streets. And with George, my buddy, we were fighting. We fought this other group of kids from another area. And somebody yelled at one point, "Get that white." And you're, "Yeah, get that white." And George said, "They're talking about you, fool." And I went, "Oh." So here I was, a member of a black gang. And I didn't see any color difference. We knew each other because of our reputations. And that's the way it was on the street.
When you first started doing acting in shows like Car 54, Where Are You? And again, you were still a young kid. When success came in that route, did you ever hear from or see the old gang from the neighborhood? What did they think of you becoming an actor? Well, first of all, what did they think of you becoming a cop? And then what did they think of you becoming an actor?
Well, when they learned that I was a cop, they looked at me and said, "Oh, man." In fact, the older guys that with really unsavory reputations looked at me and they said, "Hank, we just want to talk to you. You know an awful lot, and we don't want it to go any further. Do you understand?" I said, "Of course I do." And at one point, they called me the hoodlum cop. And I was very uncomfortable. I did my job, but I didn't last very long. I was only on the job for a few months the opportunity arrived for me to do Car 54. So it was strange. I didn't know who I was. When I got a look at my birth certificate, there were four different last names. My father was in the country illegally. He met my mom, who had two boys. Her husband had died. My father and my mother got together, and he assumed her last name, her married name, to hide out. And I found out my father was known to the mob as Big Sam. All these things I learned later in life. So it was really, really messed up beginning.
Let's take a look at some of the people you've worked with as an actor in television and films. I mentioned in the introduction people like Sophia Loren, Kirk Douglas. We already talked about Robert Redford, James Coburn. The list goes on and on and on. What's it like, a kid like you, coming along, working as an actor, and working with people like Sophia Loren and Kirk Douglas?
Oh, my God. I kept pinching myself. I couldn't believe it. Sophia, I worked with her. We were in the British West Indies, and we were doing this film, and I had an accident. I got hurt, and I was on the borderline of being unconscious, and my then wife was at the hotel. Someone came running, got her. She come running down, and she saw me lying in Sophia Loren's lap. And then Sophia is blotting the blood on my head, and she's calling me, "Poor baby, poor baby." And my wife saw me lying in Sophia Loren's lap, and she looked at me and said, "Are you comfortable?" And I said, "Well, I make a nice living." That was it. She ran back to the hotel, packed the bags, and flew back to New York.
Oh, dear.
Oh, God, I can't even remember. But I guess I was in my 20s. And we flew back to New York, and I flew back to New York and followed her, and then we reconciled. And one evening, we were walking along on Madison Avenue. It was, I guess, about 7 o'clock, 7:30. And there's a small hotel in the 60s or 70s. And it's kind of a private hotel. And I see the door open, and I see two guys come out, and they're looking around. And I said, "Bodyguards." And out comes Sophia. Now she sees me, and she runs across the street and says, "Oh, my darling, how are you?" And she's hugging me. And all I hear in the background is, "Taxi! Taxi!" And she took a cab, and it wasn't too long before we were separated and divorced.
Ouch.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
What movie did you work with Kirk Douglas?
Boy. I can't even remember the names of the films. Sophia, we did, because when we were shooting in the British West Indies, and that's where I met James Coburn. And James remembered me as a wrestler, and he called me he kept calling me Minnesota. "Hey, Minnesota, you were wonderful. Man, I love you." Blah, 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 blah. And we became good friends. Oh, boy. I honestly can't recall. It was so long ago.
What was the favorite thing, if anything, that you worked on? What's your favorite memory as an actor?
It has to be Condor. Redford was incredible. Sidney Pollack called me several times, and we did interview sessions together. In fact, at one time they were viewing Car 54, and they had the writers and Condor, and the ovation I got absolutely blew my mind. I said, "Oh my God!" And a couple of times I thought to myself, "Wow, if people on 111th could see me now." Mm-hmm. And at one point, I was being introduced to a vast audience, and it was the same feeling. Then I said to myself, "Hey, Pop, does this make you proud?" But I spent very little time with my father. So, yeah, just, and now what I do is, thanks to my manager, Deanna Marie Smith, I go to institutions where children are being imprisoned, and I talk to kids from from 11 to 17 that are incarcerated, and I just talk to them about the fact that I was there where they were, and the difference was, God sent me an angel. And I tell the kids that there's an angel out there for each and every one. But you got to be ready to listen. You listen with your ears and your heart. And that's the difference, for me anyway. And I tell them that it's waiting for you.
When you've done a lot of comedy, starting with Car 54. You've played a lot of heavies in dramatic parts. What do you enjoy doing more as an actor? Do you like playing the bad guy, or do you like doing a nicer character, or what's your preference?
I don't have a preference. Just as long as I'm performing. For me, standing up and doing my act and getting laughs is so exciting. It's invigorating, and I love making people laugh. That's what I did in Vietnam. I volunteered to go front line. I did front line entertainment. I volunteered. I paid my own way three times that I went, and seeing these kids laugh. In fact, a number of years later, went to visit the moving wall, and the wall is just a reminder of the kids that were lost in Vietnam. And a guy came up to me, and he said, "Mr. Garrett." I said, "Yes." He says, "I remember you from Vietnam." And he said, "You brought us laughter when there was nothing to laugh about."
Wow.
And that, wow. There's no award that you could give me that could match that.
Still, as an actor, as I mentioned, you played a lot of heavies, and people would recognize your face from the various myriad of movies and television shows you've done. Because of the type of roles you've often played, did you ever have a situation where either, you know, sitting down in a restaurant or walking down the street, people look at you and kind of stand back because they're not quite sure where they know you from, but they know it's sometimes bad?
Yes, exactly. In fact, a guy challenged me. He came up to me and said, "You're a pretty bad guy, right?" And I said, "No." He said, "Yeah, I understand you're a martial artist." I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "I'd like to test to see how tough you really are." And another friend of mine, who was the six-time world champ kickboxer, named Benny the Jet Urquidez, he leaned over and said to the guy, "Don't fool with him, because if you hit him or go to hit him, he will kill you." And the guy went, "Oh, is he really that martial artist?" He said, "He's a outstanding martial artist." So the guy went, "Hey, man, I was just fooling with you. Just wanted to see how tough you are." And he walked away.
Well,
he kept looking over his shoulder.
Well, I have learned from many years of watching you on the screen that Hank Garrett is not a person to be messed with. I know that. The book is called From Harlem Hoodlum to Hollywood Heavy. Hank, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us. Continued success and be well.
Well, thank you so very much. Thank you for having me on your show.
Hank Garrett, author of From Harlem Hoodlum to Hollywood Heavy. He really is a prince of a guy. Really. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0587, and you'll find links to Hank's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, the best thing since sliced bread. No loafing here.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com about a weird history story that deals with November. Plus, we also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff All program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a woman is facing several charges after an incident at a hotel on Jacksonville, Florida's south side ended with a truck submerged in a retention pond. The excitement started just before 5 p.m. at the Extended Stay Deluxe Hotel. I'm beginning to see part of the problem here. Looking for breakfast at 5 p.m. Police said they were called to the hotel in reference to an armed dispute. According to the report, a hotel employee told police a woman, later identified by police as 34-year-old Marlo Walton, began arguing with her in the lobby because there was no breakfast available at the hotel and because the pool was closed because of COVID-19. A man waiting in line at the hotel lobby told police when he saw the woman yelling at the guest service receptionist, he told her to settle down. We're not sure what happened next because of a redacted police report, but later the man was in fear for his life and left the lobby. The man went to the parking lot and got inside his vehicle, but when he saw the woman in the parking lot, he parked the vehicle and ran off. When he came back, he saw his vehicle was gone. Police said Walton took off in the truck and ended up in the retention pond across the street from the hotel. The truck was partially submerged. Walton was arrested and faces charges for theft of a motor vehicle, criminal mischief, battery, assault, and aggravated battery. Now, during the arrest, Walton became irate and began kicking the back seat of the patrol vehicle. No word on whether or not she was screaming, "Are we there yet?" She was, however, placed in restraints. See what happens when you miss the most important meal of the day? Yeah. A vehicle traveling along Portal Way in Whatcom County, Washington, was dragging something. According to the local sheriff's office Facebook post, the something was setting off sparks. Deputies discovered two people and two safes at a storage facility. Only Wendell Davidson was arrested. He was already wanted. Then deputies learned that the safes had been reported stolen in a nearby burglary, and the victims identified the safes that had been dragged as theirs. So deputies tracked down Tyler Fellman and arrested him too. Plus, they got search warrants for the storage units associated with both suspects. The investigation is still ongoing. Here's a tip. If you want to avoid police attention, dragging safes down the road and setting off sparks is probably not a good strategy. And the one thing that is completely baffling to me is that in all the years of combing the globe for Stuff File news items, this isn't even close to the first story of people dragging stolen safes and/or ATMs behind a vehicle. Heck, this isn't even the first one this year. There may be sparks, but it's not sparks of genius. And finally, in this section of Stuff File news, before we get to our last guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an elementary school in France put up a pair of posters outside their fence with an unusual request for parents: don't throw late students over the closed gate. The Trilade School in Avignon put the signs up outside its gate showing a cartoon of a parent sending a small child airborne to get over the fence. The text on the sign asked parents to not throw their children and instead wait for the gates to open again at 10 a.m. or 3 p.m. Principal Sana Mezayan said the parents literally threw their children over the gate when they arrived to find it closed. Mezayan said there were only a few scattered incidents and no reported injuries, but there were enough tossed children to inspire school officials to take action and post the warnings as a reminder. See, this just goes to show that in Europe, people are healthier. Here in North America, the parents aren't fit enough to toss their children over a fence, and in most cases, the kids are too obese. Plus, here, parents would go big or go home. No simple tossing here. They'd use a catapult and launch the kid into a second-story open window. Anyway, Let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars and the curator of the website WeirdHistorian.com, is back for his monthly visit featuring a weird moment in history for the current month. The month of November deals with a clown running for president. No, really. Mark joins us once again via Skype from New York. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for being on the program. So, a clown running for president, huh?
Yeah, and it's not the one you might be thinking of. Someone different. So first, you know, I do want to say, first of all, that when you hear terms like a clown who's running for president and politics are a circus and all the clowns in politics, it's not a term that I think is appropriate. I think clowns are people who bring joy to people and entertain people, and circuses are the same talented people who bring joy to families everywhere, right? So why do we have to insult them with comparing them to bad politicians? But there was one case where an actual clown did run for president. His name was Dan Rice, and he was a candidate for the presidency in 1868. And Dan Rice is a name that probably most people don't know. But at the time, he was one of the most famous people in America as a clown. Of course, he was even more than a clown. He was a true entertainer and a showman. He did a little bit of everything. You know, he had his own circus. He did singing. He did dancing. Of course, he did clowning. He worked with animals. At one point in his career, he worked with an educated pig early in his career. And the pig would answer questions and, you know, entertain the audience as he would sing and dance. And, you know, it was just a whole show.
Wow, an educated pig, you know, that would probably lived a long time, because an educated pig, you don't eat that all at one time.
That's true. Probably had a bit of a life extension with his skills. I mean, this guy, Dan Rice, though, I mean, he really was an interesting character. And you know, I mentioned that people probably don't know his name. But what is interesting is that people probably do know a lot of things that came from him. In fact, a lot of phrases that we use, like one horse show, actually originated from Rice's career. Early on, he could only afford one horse in his show. And his competition thought his, quote, one horse show would be a failure. But he proved them wrong, and he was really successful. Same thing with jumping on the bandwagon. That's another term that came from Dan Rice's career. He had invited the future president, this was earlier than he ran, Zachary Taylor, to campaign on a circus wagon. And he was using the circus wagon's music to attract attention for the candidate. So there you go. He had Taylor jumping on the bandwagon. And Taylor later made Rice an honorary colonel.
Wow. Even before Colonel Sanders. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Even The Greatest Show on Earth, that's so famous for Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey, was used before then to describe Rice's show by a newspaper in Arkansas. So all this sort of terminology that's kind of come through, you know, the ages, you never know where those origins are. Several of them go back to Dan Rice's career, which is pretty interesting. In fact, because he did so many different things on stage, his career also kind of helped evolve into vaudeville.
Which party did he run under as the clown president or president?
So he was Democratic. Before he ran for president, he actually ran for the state Senate in Pennsylvania. So he had all these sort of titles in the entertainment world, and he decided he tried to add politician to the list of his titles. That didn't end up happening. He didn't become a state senator. But then by November of 1867, a newspaper in Pennsylvania decided to put his name into the running for the presidency. And I'll just read a little bit of what they said, because it's kind of fun. They had such great language back then. He said, the newspaper said, "We hoist to our masthead this week the name of Dan Rice of Pennsylvania as our choice for president in 1868. Colonel Rice is so well and favorably known throughout the American continent as a man of unsullied character, sound principles, and strict integrity that it is unnecessary for us to say more at this time than to announce his name as a candidate for the presidency in the approaching campaign."
Wow. Where are people like that anymore?
They're hard to find. I mean, now, you know, all those things don't apply to one of the guys who was running.
Yeah. So if I'm correct in remembering my history, he didn't win.
That's correct. Dan Rice was not the president. He did keep the campaign going for a little while, and he had, you know, supporters, and he had some people who were, of course, against him. And certainly there were those who thought a clown, no matter what kind of clown he was, they thought a clown should not be running the country. Of course, I wish more of that happened, you know, 4 years ago. but yeah, eventually he decided that he wasn't getting the support he needed. He recognized the fact he didn't have the support he needed. And so he did withdraw, from the race. That was just for your history notes. That year was when Ulysses S. Grant defeated Horatio Seymour, to become the 18th president of the United States.
You know, it would be almost interesting if anybody out there knew about this history, if they, maybe even you, were to start the Dan Rice Party in his memory.
Yeah, that would be kind of great. Where you'd have people of unsullied character and integrity running for president. I think that would do really well for the country.
Do we know anything about Dan post-election?
In what I wrote, I didn't go past the election only because, you know, the story I wrote was in particular about his run and a little bit of his history. I think, like I said, he kind of like got into a little bit of the vaudeville world. But I think eventually, you know, like anyone, he aged out a little bit and his career came to an end. But like I said, he was definitely one of the most famous people. He was earning, just to give you a little context of how well and successful he was doing, he was earning $1,000 a week at one point in the 1800s.
Wow. That's very impressive, actually.
That's really good money for back then, for sure.
I'm beginning to wonder, you know, someone who's earning $1,000 a week, is he just very frugal or extremely cheap? Because how do you earn $1,000 a week in the 1800s and still only have a one-horse show?
Well, the one horse show was early on.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So the $1,000 a week came a little bit later.
So he could afford more horses later on, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm sure he could buy. Well, it's funny now that you mentioned the horses. He certainly had horses, but he started having lots of other animals he worked with as well. He had cattle, he had elephants, and he was also the first person to train a rhinoceros to perform in the circus ring. So you can see the man was a true innovator in terms of entertainment and what he could do and what he could bring to people's lives and you know, bring smiles to people.
Now, since he was running as a Democrat, it means that he would have lost in the primary phase, right? When he didn't make it to become, obviously, he didn't make it to become the nominee for the party.
Right, yeah. He came out of the race earlier during the primaries, exactly.
Do you know how many people he was running against?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. I doubt it was quite as robust as it is these days, you know, where you have 20 candidates on the stage. So the competition was probably a little slimmer. But like I said, he just saw that he didn't have quite the support he needed to go the distance.
Because I'm assuming that somebody was still behind him, no matter where he was, that he wasn't running last. So I'm guessing there's somebody out there who could say, I don't know, I'm losing to some clown.
I'm sure you're right. I'm sure people didn't take too kindly to that. They did, in fact, lose to a clown in their bid for the presidency.
Well, I'm hoping that someone out there takes note and decides to resurrect the memory of Dan Rice in a political kind of way, maybe starting a party, maybe from the, you know, because you have, for instance, the splintering of the Republican Party in the United States right now. You have the Lincoln Project. Maybe there should be a Dan Rice faction.
Yeah, that could be good. Maybe that's just what they need.
Yeah, a place for him in history. Mark, always a pleasure to have you on. Looking forward to talking to you next month, Christmas month, the holiday period, to see what's happening in history then.
That'll be fun. I'll look forward to it.
Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars. His website is weirdhistorian.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0587, and you'll find the link to Mark's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
When a man stepped up to the teller at a bank in Fallbrook, California, the teller said to do business with the bank during the pandemic, he had to wear a mask. The man walked outside, put on a mask, and returned. He handed the teller a deposit slip with a note on the back, "Don't do any sudden movements." It started. It was a robbery. The teller handed over cash and the man left. Security cameras got a good photo of his face from the first round, and the robber is being sought by the FBI, so it's just a matter of time. You know, it's fairly common knowledge these days that it's not considered to be the brightest move if you don't wear a mask in public because of COVID-19. So, why? Oh, why? If you're walking into a bank to rob it in 2020, would you not be wearing a mask from the get-go? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0587. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0587. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.